Welcome to Flipper Talks, a family law podcast. We are Flipper, the Family Law Practitioners Association of Queensland. Family law is a wonderfully rewarding career, but is not without its challenges. Join us as we explore the issues that impact on the practice and well-being of family law practitioners. We hope our episodes will not only inform and inspire you, but encourage you to reach your potential. Enjoy this episode.
One of the key challenges for our community of recent years has been addressing the scourge of family violence. It's a challenge that has had a lot of societal and media attention, and in 2023 and early 2024, a lot of legislative attention. I'm Matt Taylor, and on this episode of Flipper Talks, we'll be looking at domestic violence. A little later, we'll hear from Barrister Raymond Hee, who will bring us up to speed on how domestic violence is being dealt with amongst our Pacific neighbours. But before we hear from Raymond, let's start closer to home. I'm delighted to invite onto the podcast to talk about recent developments in Queensland, Nadia Bromley, CEO of Women's Legal Service Queensland. Nadia, welcome.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Welcome, and thank you very much. Let's get straight into it. In 2023, we had the Domestic and Family Violence Protection, Combating Coercive Control and Other Legislation Amendment Act. It commenced in August 2023 and made changes to a number of pieces of legislation, including bringing our definition of stalking into the electronic age, gave us some guidance on exactly what the 2012 Act meant when it asked the courts to identify the party most in need of protection, and made explicit that domestic violence includes patterns of behaviour, not acts. What has been the experience of Women's Legal Service Queensland and your clients arising out of those changes?
Look, Matt, I think the truth of it is any change takes time, right? This Act has been in a long time. We're reviewing an Act that was in 2012 and we're in 2024. So yeah. I think we can expect that arc to be quite long. Look, overall, our experience has been positive. But if I'm honest, to be quite frank, the most positive thing we've seen so far is more consistency. Because there has been that attention around it, because we've seen the changes, we have seen a more consistent approach across the courts. Yes. And fundamentally, although this might not sound like a lofty game, that's one of the most important things we can have for our clients, because it means we can give them accurate advice. If we know what's going to happen, we can get them better prepared and informed to engage with the courts themselves.
Because there's an extent, isn't there? We might talk about the changes in the 2023 legislation, but a lot of those were scaffolding or clarification of things that were already in the 2012 Act.
Absolutely. But you know as well as I do, Matt, systems drive behaviours. And I think the reality of the Magistrates Court is they are very busy places. They deal with 95% of the matters that go through our criminal courts in this state. Magistrates have got a lot on their mind. Prosecutors have got a lot on their mind. Courts fall into habits. So I think it never hurts to have a reminder of actually, this is what we meant. This is what you should be focusing on. Here's the harm that's caused when you don't.
And I guess an example of that, where we've now got the specific reference to patterns of behaviour, provide some guidance, because, of course, 2012 removed the need for an act of domestic violence. But we were still, certainly from my experience, still finding in those proceedings that, well, what are the acts that I'm being taken to? Because this is court, this is evidence.
Absolutely, yeah.
And if I can bring that back to another section that I think raised at the top and I think is really interesting, is Section 22A. Which deals with cross applications. And of course, the 2012 Act already provided that in the case of cross applications, the court should try and determine who is the party most in need of protection. We now get some guidance on that. Can I ask you to comment on how your team and how your clients are seeing that section work?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think Section 22A is one of the most positive changes we've seen, certainly for courts and certainly for practitioners. So for practitioners, it provides scaffolding for submissions, right? It's a nice way to work through the things you need to convince the court of and talk to the court about. But for courts, it also provides a really practical guide. And I think the best thing about it is it brings everybody's mind back to the basis, the thing that we're talking about. We're not talking about incidents. We're not talking about moments of violence. We're not talking about situational things. We're talking about coercive or a dominance of power and control. We're talking about a relationship that involves subjugation. It's about that dominance, and that really brings people's minds back to, I need to sort of step back and take a look at the broader relationship. So that's been really helpful. The one caveat I would apply to that is I don't know that it's been as useful for clients. It's important to remember that's in the act.
Yes.
Right? And we know our clients who are self-represented don't have as sort of ready access to legislation or ability to use it. So if I think about the clients in regional and rural locations where there are no duty lawyers, has it provided them any greater assistance? Look, maybe not.
Can I ask it in this context? Because, of course, that's about when it gets to court, what the court is deciding. But, of course, the front line isn't the court, that's down the track. It's often the QPS. It comes down to that issue of identifying or misidentifying the perpetrator or a perpetrator at a coalface. And I think, to be fair to the police and what I've seen in terms of their submissions, they've wrestled with the difficulties of that. Have you seen, or is there any indication that this guidance, albeit that it's further down the track, is assisting them?
Yes, look, I think so. And I think it's important to remember that they find themselves in an invidious situation. None of us want to be dealing with this crisis. And I think the police find themselves under-resourced, oversubscribed, turning up at incidents that are heated, that do involve violence. And it's hard to look away from that and to step back, right? And I think there's also the overlay there in Section 100 of the Act that they have an obligation to investigate. There's a legislative driver saying, find out where the problem is and identify it and provide a legal remedy. So it's in that context that they're trying to do this. So yes, this absolutely should be helpful for them. But I think there's been a lot thrown at the QPS in the last 18 months in terms of training and trying to do the cultural uplift. So yeah, I we're hopeful, but I think we just need to give a bit of space.
Certainly, certainly. The next question, and I may be putting you on the spot here, I go back to the bench book for DV matters. And we know from that 2016 District Court Judge Administrator Smith basically made the comment in case law, nailed the issue, and I'll see if I can find it quickly. I think I've got it tagged here. Both people in a relationship cannot be a victim and a perpetrator of this type of violence at the same time. A cross-application may be used by a respondent to continue victimising the aggrieved person to exact revenge or to gain a tactical advantage in other court proceedings. That was 2016. Did we really need to wait 7 years to get this guidance?
Yeah, look, fair question. Though I think, Matt, and I don't mean this in a depressing way, but I think it's important to remember where we came from, right? If you think about, and I don't know how the judge would feel about this comparison, but if you think about the kind of things Justice Kirby was saying in the late 90s, in the Heather Osland case,
yes,
like the things he was talking about, the language he was using, we took 20 years to get to.
Yep.
So I think that arc of change is quite long. And I think the problem is, this isn't a thing that you can just change the law and everybody's behaviours will change. They both need to happen. So I think, obviously, we want things to happen as fast as they can to reduce community harm. But in the scheme of things, 7 years isn't a bad outcome.
I'm going to pick up on something you said in terms of change community and sort of step away from the legislation a bit, because one of the things that we often hear, certainly from the media point of view and in the media space, is in relation to raising awareness. How much more does our awareness need to be raised? Again, similar sort of question. Shouldn't we know much of this by now?
We should, absolutely. But it's important to remember, and I think that's what sits underneath all of this for me, which I think is really great, is that talking about dominance and use of power and control and coercive control is getting back to the problem. It's getting back to the person using violence, right? Because I think our dialogue on this for 20, 30 years has been so victim-focused. And, of course, we want to intervene and support victims, but it's not their behaviour we need to change. So we might be aware of it, but if one in five women are experiencing domestic or sexual violence, maybe one in five other people are using it, right? So I think there's a difference between awareness and behaviour change.
Okay. Well, that's actually a useful jumping in because, of course, we've had the 2023 tranche of amendments,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of those, the heavy lifting, in my words, is done in terms of the criminal code.
Sure.
But there are still some changes to our legislation, the Domestic and Family Violence Protection Act 2012. some of those amendments being relating to perpetrator diversion programs. Mm. Now, that, of course, has been, again, in the 2012 Act, since then, provision for in making an order whether the court could have regard to those programs, the availability, what's been done. It does seem that we're getting a little bit more meat on those bones.
Look, absolutely. And I think obviously everyone wants to focus on primary prevention. It's better for the community, it's cheaper, it's better for the legal system. If the violence stops, that's a better outcome, of course. And we know that early intervention in these kind of behaviours is actually very successful. I suppose the challenge and the thing we'd want to keep our eye on is the availability and the suitability of programs.
Yes.
Because the last thing we'd like to see is people presenting before a court, finally getting the courage to get the police to make an application or making an application themselves, seeing that breached and prosecution coming back to the court and the matter being diverted for 6 months.
Yes.
With no additional safety for them while that person is waiting a behaviour change program.
Yeah.
So I think making sure there are sufficient programs and making sure they're sufficiently qualified that they're not actually just increasing risk, right? Because it's a difficult space to work.
And it's certainly one of the concerns within the family law space has always been that whether it's a diversion program or a perpetrator program, however one men's behaviour change, however one describes it, that where the motivation is other than personal change, they can do little more than teach the words, as it were. What are your? Do you have any comments on that generally, and the effectiveness of the of programs?
Yeah, and look, I think that's the challenge. I don't think there's enough research in this space. We haven't seen the funding for the program such that they can be evaluated because, as you well know, there are layers over the top of this as well. So the things that drive women who are misidentified to consent to orders and have them made are the same things that might drive people to do behavioural programs so it looks like they're participating. And those include parenting arrangements, family law proceedings. So it is a rich tapestry of behavioural context in which we find ourselves. So I think the more empirical data we can have, the better.
Fantastic. Thank you. Other things that are in the most recent legislation are length of orders, Section 37. If the court decides to make a protection order against the respondent, the court must consider the appropriate period for which the order is to continue in force. Now, of course, 2012, it was subsequent to that, I think 2016 made it the five-year order as the standard. What are you hoping to see with this specific consideration of the length of orders?
Look, something different to what we've seen so far is the answer, because the challenge we've found with our clients and the task force found is that there was a default, which is fine. There has to be a default, right? We're lawyers, we know that. But the default became the norm. Every order was for 5 years.
Yes.
And so when women were consenting without, you know, to orders and that was impacting their life for 5 years, that was disproportionate. Similarly, where there were people in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities who had orders for 5 years, creating complexity in their lives. But the reality in our experience is that courts are yet to sort of turn their minds to that. We're not seeing shorter orders.
Could we, I'm really interested to hear that comment because it comes back to, doesn't it, what is the purpose of the order? And the purpose of the order is safety. And again, in the objects, to respect and minimise the impact on the aggrieved. So what that means is if a shorter order is best for them, then that needs to be considered rather than just assuming that longer is safer.
Absolutely. And look, it's such a complex environment because you'd appreciate there's also been an amendment to Section 51, which is about orders can be made without their consent.
Yes.
Controversial, right? Because a lot of this act is actually about empowering victim survivors to make choices,
yes,
to know what makes them safe. They've kept themselves safe to this point, you know, to have some agency in their life. So controversially, they changed Section 51 to allow orders to be made even if aggrieved didn't consent.
Yes.
I don't know how, and we haven't got any statistics on that, but I think the flip side of that is they should also be heard then on the length of the order.
Yes.
You know, if they
yes.
don't want it to happen, maybe they should be in for a shorter period so, you know, some evaluation. So I think it's so difficult because there is so much potential harm. I think risks are high. So I think you'll find police and courts act in a risk-averse way.
Yes.
But actually that could create more harm in some circumstances.
Section 47B, new Section 47B, if the court adjourns the hearing of the application at the first mention, the court must consider whether to make a temporary order. So now it's not that the court can make one, they must consider. And I guess the parallel, or a parallel where the court was required to consider, because consider doesn't seem particularly strong, was where there were children involved, they've had a requirement to consider whether to name them on the order. Can I get you to comment on that change, the need to consider the temporary order and whether there might be any parallels and why that might provide a strengthening to just may make an order?
Yes. And look, I think it goes back to my earlier point about the Magistrates Court is a very busy place. And so this, to my mind, is actually addressing a bit of a gap. So you had a police protection notice come into court. If the magistrate didn't have enough information, if there was some other irregularity or just not enough time, if the matter was adjourned, there would be no order in place.
Yes.
There was no protection. And the fact that they didn't even need to turn their mind to that is very problematic given the structure of the Act.
And I guess the other filling in that gap is the legislation that now allows for the extension of the police protection order if they don't get to it in any extent.
Yeah. That's so. And I think that's entirely appropriate because I think the challenge we often have, we are a big state. Sometimes we draft legislation thinking about George Street. It's not everyone's experience that the court sits every day.
Yes.
Or even every week.
Yeah, fair point. One of the things that I thought, and this takes us sort of perhaps outside of the Domestic and Violence, Family Violence Protection Act, but one of the things I thought was really interesting about the legislation passed earlier this year was stealthing.
Yeah.
And the recognition of reproductive violence. Can I get you to comment on that as a development, both legislatively and what Women's Legal Service Queensland see in that space?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, that's really exciting. I think that's commencing around the 23rd of September, which is good to see. Look, there'd been a lot of discussion, particularly around stealthing, with people saying, well, you don't need to change the law. That's already captured under the existing provisions. And look, maybe it was, but I think this case is a really excellent example of the power of the law to influence community behaviour. Like if you think about rape, right, yep. How many rape trials are there in a year in Queensland? 150, actually. Yep. And if you look at the recent stats from the Queensland Sentencing Advisory Council, across the last 18 years, only about 2,500 people have been convicted of rape.
Yep.
It's about 135 a year. Tragically, we know a lot more rapes occur in this state than that.
Yep.
So if the courts aren't dealing with the matters, then it isn't sufficient to deal with jury directions because 150 juries are going to hear in a confined space something that actually doesn't get anywhere broader in the community, right?
Yep.
So I think the introduction of that law has caused conversations in the community. It will go into the supportive relationships education through school. So I think it's actually a really good example of the law as an education tool. Like the law's supposed to function as the rules we agree on, right, yep. About how we behave yes. with
yep.
each other.
Yep.
I think this is a really great example of embedding that up front because when people know it up front, then there aren't criminal prosecutions, then there isn't that ongoing harm, right?
Right. So this is a case where that awareness, at least on some level, arises from embedding this in the legislation.
Absolutely. I just don't think, save for this amendment, we would have had the kind of conversations we're having. And that goes for people who need to know what their rights are, but also people who need to know how they can behave. Chanel Contos is an amazing advocate. Much of her work is talking with young men who come to her and say, I didn't know what I was doing was wrong. Right? This is a message for everybody.
Well, and going back to my earlier question about awareness, I've got to admit I have, as recently as the last 3 or 4 months, been doing a trial in the jurisdiction and put to the proposition to a father in that case that, well, this behaviour was family violence. You'd accept that. And his answer then was, well, I do now. And whilst I might personally be sceptical as to why it took so long, perhaps there is something in that.
For sure. And what an amazing engagement to have. I mean, there's never a bad time for a good thing to happen.
Fair point. I'd like to get then to perhaps the underlying basis for a lot of these changes, not just in the state legislation, but in the federal sphere as well, and the changes to the Family Law Act. And I think it's fair to say it comes from a reframing or a re-understanding of coercive control in family violence generally. In particular, and I think it's the ANROs 2021 where I've sort of first seen it referenced, the concept that coercive control isn't just a branch of family violence. It is a fundamental basis for a lot of it. I think I've tried to come up with words earlier and came up with the concept that family violence is not about abusers losing control of themselves. It's about abusers seeking to control their partner. What do you think is exciting, if I can use that word, about that reframing of our conception of family violence?
That is so exciting. I think that is a revolution in terms of the way we think and talk about it and the way we legislate for it, right? I think it's just such a reframe. And I think it came from a good place, right? Like you said, if you think about people committing acts of control or violence to someone else, your brain naturally goes, why would that happen? Why did this particular behavior, why did we see that exhibited? I wouldn't do that. Why did that happen, right? Which is, the law has a terrible history of having its own lens, right?
Yep.
How would I behave? If I was demonstrating that behavior, why would that happen, right? But it's different. It's about that architecture of subjugation. It's designed to destroy someone else. Sort of that intimate terrorism is how it's described, yeah. Right? So I think it gives us an opportunity to better understand and identify it, but also to a point I was talking to before, it gives us an opportunity to actually look at the legal problem. Because while we're looking at the punching and the financial abuse, what we're not seeing is the behavior we need to stop.
Yes. And again, I started and I've come back a number of times. So why has it taken so long? But it also occurs to me that this is a continuation of some of the thinking and writing that now Justice Tom Altobelli was doing in 2010 when he was looking at classifying the different types of violence. Is this, might it be reactive violence in the context of a separation, or might it be? And is this sort of a culmination, if you like, of that thinking?
Look, I think so. And I think the other exciting thing that we perhaps haven't talked about, which you mentioned just now, is the concept of reactive violence too. I think this also gives us an opportunity to better understand people experiencing coercive control, because response to that kind of trauma looks different to what we'd expect. And so we do see reactive violence. We do see protective behaviours. We do see things that could be categorised themselves as domestic and family violence. So I think it gives us an opportunity to see everybody's behaviour with a little more nuance and a little more understanding of that broader context.
And it does, when we're talking about misidentifying, it brings it right back to that, isn't it? Whether it's the court or the Queensland Police or practitioners or anyone involved, it brings part of that question becomes, where does the power sit within this relationship, and how might that play out?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the question everybody needs to ask themselves, because that's what gets lost in the sort of transactional, this happened, there were these behaviours, she smashed his car, he did this, right? That gets lost in that kind of transactional analysis.
Well, then, as you said, it's early days. We've had this legislation for 12 months. And the legislation earlier in the year, we're still waiting for that to come into effect. What are you, as the CEO of Women's Legal Service Queensland, what are you hoping to see over the course of the next 12 or 18 months?
I'm hoping that we can see greater collaboration and communication across systems, because I think there's been a series of upheavals. The Queensland Police Service have got a lot of work to do. I think across the state and the federal sphere, we see the federal government tabling legislation yesterday that includes some really positive things. I'd just love to see all of those systems working together to actually create a coherent experience for people, and that they can just get more sensible, clearer outcomes. And I think lawyers have a significant role to play. That is a complicated space in which we work.
Thank you. Before we sign off, I'll ask, is there anything that you want to say about, because I've asked you all about family violence, I haven't given you an opportunity to say anything about Women's Legal Service Queensland, We know you do great work. We've had both in Flipper and within the legal community. We're big fans of your work. Do you want to say a little bit about what you're doing at the moment and what the next 12 or 18 months holds for Women's Legal Service Queensland?
Yeah, look, absolutely. And obviously we're the service there to sort of a safety net. Right? We catch the people who can't go anywhere else. But there are lots of service systems that work around with us, and it's so important that we can have good relationships and work with everybody else. And the Family Law Bar has been very, very kind to us for the 40 years we've been in operation, and that's why it still works for us. So looking at the next sort of 12 to 18 months ahead, obviously some of the law reform in the federal space we'll certainly have our eyes on. The implementation of some of the other laws, obviously coercive control is a good step forward, but also a significant risk for us and certainly for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women. So that's a space we'll be watching. But in terms of our key focus is probably getting out into those regional and remote places, the places where there aren't duty lawyers and courts, the places where there aren't services. So we've actually got a new circuit about to start up of our lawyers, social workers and financial counsellors moving through the state to make sure that we're creating as much access as we can.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you, Nadia.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
Joined now by Raymond He. Raymond is a barrister and nationally accredited mediator. He has a broad practice which includes family law, commercial litigation, administrative law and human rights throughout Australia, the South Pacific and Southeast Asia. Before being called to the bar, Raymond worked as a solicitor, as a registrar of the Supreme Court of Tonga, as a judge's associate and as a legal officer at a UN-backed war crimes tribunal in Cambodia. Ray, you recently delivered a paper for the Bar Association of Queensland exploring the response to family violence among Pacific nations. Tell us about that.
Thanks for having me, Matt. Yes, Matt, I sit on the Bar Association's South Pacific Regional Education Committee, and the committee is currently delivering a series of workshops and papers on civil domestic violence to South Pacific practitioners. The paper is a review of the comparison of the civil domestic violence legislation of eight jurisdictions, looking at the commonalities and the differences.
Well, let's start broadly then. What did you see as some of the common features, both amongst the eight nations that you looked at and also commonalities with Queensland's legislation?
Quite hearteningly, there was a lot of commonality between each of the jurisdictions in that there is an ability to apply for a civil protection order in terms of the elements that one must meet in order to obtain a civil protection order. They're largely the same as here in Queensland in that there must be some element of a relevant relationship. There has been an act of domestic violence or likely to be an act of domestic violence. And thirdly, whether or not an order is necessary or desirable. There are, of course, slightly different legislative formulations on those tests, but broadly, there's the test is the same in each of the jurisdictions. Other areas of commonality are the definition of family and domestic violence. It's a very broad definition that includes more than just physical domestic and family violence, includes coercive control to an extent. It's a very broad definition. The definition of family under the various acts also extend to protect those outside the nuclear family, to include members of one's extended family. And there's also a provision to provisions to allow for temporary protection orders and third parties such as police officers or authorised persons can apply for orders to protect aggrieved persons.
So if we're drilling down into a few of those, you spoke about the definition of family violence. Queensland, of course, now has as broad a definition of family violence as it's ever had, and includes with the recent changes discussions of patterns of behaviour. How does that compare to the jurisdictions that you looked at?
Well, there are some jurisdictions which go so far as to explicitly state that family and domestic violence includes patterns of behaviour. For example, in Samoa, the definition of family and domestic violence includes any other controlling or abusive behaviour towards a complainant where such conduct harms or may cause imminent harm to safety, health, or well-being of the complainant.
So at least in that jurisdiction, whilst it may not use the term coercive control, it certainly encompasses issues of controlling behaviour.
That's so, Matt. And another jurisdiction which, again, does not explicitly use the words coercive controlling behaviour, but does use very broad language to include patterns of behaviour, include Nauru, which talks about persistently behaving in an abusive, cruel, inhumane, degrading, provocative, or offensive manner. Fiji has another example as well.
So, and you also spoke about the possibility of police taking out orders. And of course, we know in Queensland that often the first point of contact in respect of family violence and in respect of obtaining family violence orders may be the police. How is that reflected in these other jurisdictions?
Most of the jurisdictions have an ability for police to all these jurisdictions have the ability for police to be applicants for a civil DV order, but not all the jurisdictions have the ability for the police to issue what we have here in Queensland, a police protection notice. Of the eight jurisdictions I looked at, Tonga had provisions for that. So did the Cook Islands, Solomon Islands, and Nauru. I wasn't able to identify in the Samoan legislation, Papua New Guinean legislation, Fijian or Vanuatu legislation, a provision where the police can issue a protection notice on an interim basis while the matter waits to come to court.
So presumably then that requires the matter to have some form of court hearing on either a private or police application before that protective order is made.
So it seems.
Now, we're talking in terms of the headlines, that they're getting the order, but often we know that it's about the detail, and by that I mean conditions. How are conditions dealt with in the jurisdictions you looked at?
Well, all the jurisdictions have a similar provision, such as our mandatory condition that a respondent must be of good behaviour and not commit domestic violence towards an aggrieved or a protected person or a named person. There were other conditions which are similar to what we have here in Queensland, such as a ban on a person having weapons or weapons licenses. There are also conditions which allow the court to impose, the court can impose conditions such as ouster conditions. And in the Cook Islands in particular, there's an interesting mandatory ouster provision, which is included by provision of their act.
I've noticed that in your paper. So a situation that occurs somewhat commonly in our jurisdiction, wherein parties may have the benefit of an order but continue to live under the one roof, presumably couldn't take place in the Cook Islands.
It appears to be the case that the in the Cook Islands, the conditions require, when a protection order is made there, it is a mandatory condition that the respondent be ousted from the property.
Interesting.
And, of course, there are other social issues around that, which I'm not qualified to speak to, but having previously lived and worked in a small island jurisdiction, it's very easy to conceive of issues around that respondent finding somewhere, being able to live, notwithstanding they're likely to be related to somebody else living in that small village. Those sorts of issues are.
Well, and at the risk of editorialising, I wonder whether that mandatory condition, useful as it sounds on the first blush, may create a reticence about applying for an order because of those housing and separation and forced ouster requirements.
Yes.
Tell me then, certainly in terms of the committee that you're on with the Bar Association and the program that you're doing, why? So it sounds like many of the concepts that practitioners here in Queensland will be familiar with are reflected in the jurisdictions that you've looked at. What else is worth knowing for Queensland practitioners who are may find themselves practicing or being giving advice in relation to these matters in South Pacific jurisdictions?
A very interesting provision I found in the Fijian Domestic Violence Act 2009 was the ability for the Fijian jurisdiction to register and enforce overseas orders. Of course, it comes as no surprise to anyone practicing in Australia that since 2017, civil domestic violence protection orders made in one state or territory will apply and be enforceable in all Australian states and territories. And Australia has, of course, a very long history and connection with the South Pacific, and there are many Pacific diaspora living here in Australia, and they travel back and forth from here to their home countries. And the relevance, of course, of the enforceability of overseas orders is self-evident. What I found very interesting was that Section 62 of the Fijian Act says effectively that a foreign domestic violence restraining order may be registered in a court in accordance with that section when the Attorney General receives a certified copy of that civil domestic restraining order. They must have it registered. And once it's registered, Section 64 of the Fijian Act provides that upon registration, that foreign domestic violence order has the effect and may be enforced and have the terms in it which have the same effect in Fiji as if it was an order made by their courts. So in theory, it gives that wide protection to people who may obtain an order here to protect them in Fiji, as well as may, in some circumstances, extend the court's jurisdiction in Fiji to cover acts which, such as coercive control, in the way that we've defined it here in Queensland.
Interesting. Well, thank you, Ray, for your time, and thank you for that insight into how our Pacific neighbours are dealing with family violence, a matter of course, or an issue, of course, which has been very much on the agenda for our state and our country nationally.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
Thank you for listening to Flipper Talks, a family law podcast. We hope you enjoyed the podcast today. We confirm that the information we discussed today was just that, information for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not specific advice. If something discussed has you considering whether you should take steps, it is important to make sure you get professional advice about your unique situation before you proceed, whether that be legal, financial, accounting, medical, or other advice. Please reach out to Flipper if there's another topic you'd like explored, and if you know someone who might benefit from the show, remember to tell them about it. Thank you for listening.